It looked like a good luck charm. It seemed to be an ordinary silver dollar with a metal loop at one end so it could be fastened onto a chain around the neck. The intelligence officer unscrewed the loop. Inside the dollar was a thin needle. Toward the end, there were grooves. Inside the grooves was a sticky brown substance. It was curare, he told us. Just one prick would suffice.
Ever since the beginning of my administration, I have issued directives to gather, in every feasible way, the information required to protect the United States and the free world against surprise attacks. How should we view all this activity? It is a distasteful but vital necessity.
Taking off from Peshawar, Pakistan, I was to fly 3,800 miles to Bodø in Norway. It would be the first time we had attempted to fly all the way across the Soviet Union. The planned route would take us deeper into Russia than we had ever gone, while traversing important targets never before photographed. Approaching the border, I could feel the tension build. It happened on every overflight. Once across the border, you relax a bit. After about 1.5 hours, I spotted the first break in the clouds. I was southeast of the Aral Sea, slightly right, of course. Far below, I could see the condensation trail of a single-engine jet aircraft. It was moving fast at supersonic speed, paralleling my course. I was sure that they were tracking me on radar, vectoring in and relaying my headings to the aircraft. But it was so far below as to pose no threat. Because of my altitude, it would have been almost impossible for the pilot to see me. If this was the best they could do, I had nothing to worry about. I wondered how the Russians felt, knowing I was up here, unable to do anything about it. I could make a pretty good guess. For 4 years, the U-2s had been overflying the USSR. Much of this time, if not all of it, the Russian government had been aware of our activities. Yet, because to do so would be to admit that they could do nothing to stop us, they couldn't even complain. I could imagine their frustration and rage. Imagining it made me much less complacent. Ahead, about 30 miles east of the Aral Sea, was the Tyuratam Cosmodrome, launching site for most of Russia's important ICBM and space shots. I switched on the cameras. Some intelligence was achieved, though not 100%. About 50 miles south of Chelyabinsk, the clouds disappeared. To my left, I got a good view of the Ural Mountains, still snow-topped, but on either side the land was green. It was spring in Russia. It was also a beautiful day, and now that I was back on course, the clouds behind me, I began to relax a little. About 30 to 40 miles southeast of Sverdlovsk, I made a 90-degree left turn, rolled out on course, and lined up on my next flight line, which would go over the southwestern edge of the city. I was almost exactly 4 hours into the flight. Spotting an airfield that did not appear on the map, I marked it down. My route would take me directly over it. Following the turn, I had to record the time, altitude, speed, exhaust gas temperature, and engine instrument readings. I was marking these down when suddenly there was a dull thump. The aircraft jerked forward and a tremendous orange flash lit the cockpit and sky. Knocked back in the seat, I said, "My God, I've had it now." The orange glow seemed to last for minutes, although it was probably gone in seconds. Yet I had time enough to think the explosion was external to the aircraft and from the push, probably somewhere behind it. Instinctively, I grasped the throttle with my left hand and, keeping my right hand on the wheel, checked instruments. All readings normal. Engine functioning okay. The right wing started to droop. I turned the wheel and it came back up fine. Now the nose very slowly started to go down. Proper correction for that is to pull back on the wheel to bring it up. I pulled, but it kept going down. Either the control cable had severed or the tail was gone. I knew then I had no control of the aircraft. As it kept nosing down, a violent movement shook the plane, flinging me all over the cockpit. I assumed both wings had come off. What was left of the plane began spinning, only upside down, the nose pointing upward toward the sky and the tail toward the ground. All I could see was blue sky spinning, spinning. I turned on the emergency oxygen supply. Sometime earlier, I hadn't felt it at the time. My suit had inflated, meaning I'd lost pressurization in the cockpit. The suit was now squeezing me, while the G-forces were throwing me forward out of the seat up toward the nose. I reached for the destruct switches, opening the safety covers, had my hand over them, and then changed my mind, deciding I had better see if I could get into position to use the ejection seat first. Under normal circumstances, there is only a small amount of clearance in ejecting. Looking up at the canopy rails, I estimated that using the seat in this position would sever both my legs about 3 inches above the knee. I didn't want to cut them off, but if it was the only way to get out... Thus far, I had felt no fear. Now I realized I was on the edge of panic. Stop and think. The words came back to me. A friend who had also encountered complications trying to bail out had told me of forcing himself to stop struggling and just think his way out of his predicament. I tried it, suddenly realizing the obvious. The ejection seat wasn't the only way to leave the plane. I could climb out. So intent had I been on one solution, I'd forgotten the other. Reaching up not far, I unlocked and released the canopy. It sailed off into space. The plane was still spinning. I glanced at the altimeter. It had passed 34,000 feet and was unwinding very fast. Again, I thought of the destruct switches, but decided to release my seatbelt first before activating the unit. Immediately, the centrifugal force threw me halfway out of the aircraft. With movement so quick, my body hit the rearview mirror and snapped it off. I saw it fly away. That was the last thing I saw, because almost immediately my faceplate frosted over. Something was holding me connected to the aircraft. I couldn't see what. Then I remembered the oxygen hoses. I'd forgotten to unfasten them. The aircraft was still spinning. I tried to climb back in to activate the destruct switches, but couldn't. The G-forces were too great. Reaching down, I tried to feel my way to the switches. I knew they were close, 6 inches away from my left hand at most, but I couldn't slip my hand under the windscreen to get at them. Unable to see, I had no idea how fast I was falling, how close to the ground. And then I thought, I've just got to try and save myself now. Kicking and squirming, I must have broken the oxygen hoses because suddenly I was free. My body just falling, floating perfectly free. It was a pleasant, exhilarating feeling. Even better than floating in a swimming pool, I remember thinking. I must have been in shock. I was thinking I should pull the ripcord, when a quick jerk yanked me upward. The chute had opened automatically. It had been set to open at 15,000 feet, which meant I was somewhere below that. At under 15,000 feet, I didn't need the emergency oxygen in my seat pack and could take off my faceplate. I was immediately struck by the silence. Everything was cold, quiet, and serene. There was no sensation of falling. It was as if I were hanging in the sky, no movement at all. Part of the aircraft passed me, twisting and fluttering like a leaf. I thought it was one of the wings, yet I had no way to estimate size or distance. It could have been a small piece up close or a large piece some distance away. Looking down, I saw I was still quite high, probably 10,000 feet. Below were rolling hills, showed alternate routes back to Pakistan and Turkey. I took off my gloves, took it out, carefully ripped it into little pieces, and scattered them. One piece of incriminating evidence was gone. I also remembered the silver dollar and took it out. Looking at it at this point, I realized the coin cover wasn't such a good idea after all. What better souvenir of the capture of a capitalist American pilot than a bright new U.S. dollar? It was one of the first things they would take. Unscrewing the loop at the end, I slipped out the poison pin and dropped it into my pocket, where there was a chance it would go unnoticed, then tossed away the coin. I thought about the pin, wondering whether I should use it. For a moment, I seriously considered it. Yet, I was still hopeful of escape. Only a few hundred feet remained. I spotted a small car moving along a dirt road. It seemed to be following my course. I watched as it stopped near the village, and two men got out. I also saw, almost directly under me, a plowed field, a tractor, and two men. One was on the tractor, the other standing alongside, piling brush. I missed power lines by about 25 feet, coming down near the tractor, hitting hard, the weight of my seat pack causing me to fall, slamming my head against the ground. While one of the men collapsed the chute, the other helped me to my feet. Soon, joined by the pair from the automobile, they assisted in removing the parachute harness and helmet. My head ached and my ears rang from the sudden descent. The village was less than 100 yards away. There must have been a school there, for suddenly there were 20 or 30 children running toward us, followed by almost as many adults. Everyone was questioning me at the same time. Because I couldn't speak Russian, I could neither understand them nor reply. They seemed solicitous, but also curious. When I didn't answer, I didn't even know the words for thank you, I could see that they were puzzled. With my continued silence, I could see the puzzlement changing to suspicion. A man on either side, I was helped to the car. One, spotting the pistol on the outside of my suit, reached over and took it. I didn't try and stop him. By now, the crowd numbered more than 50. In the 4 years I had worked for the agency, only once had I received instructions on what to do in the event of capture. And that, brought out by my own questioning, had been the single remark of the intelligence officer. You may as well tell them everything because they're going to get it out of you anyway. I was damned if I was going to do that. Although not sure how or if I could manage it, there were some things I was determined to keep from them at any cost. As for what lay ahead, I knew for sure only one thing. Sooner or later, they were going to kill me.
and all the rest of the world on the eve of the summit conference were asking themselves just how tough will Khrushchev have to be to make an impression on his own people. That was the view before the talks began. Perhaps his bark would be worse than his bite. Then President Eisenhower arrived. Then, of course, there was the famous conciliator and pourer of oil on troubled waters, Mr. McMillan himself.
We pulled up in front of a pair of large iron doors. The driver blew his horn. Someone looked out a peephole. There was a consultation. The doors swung open, and we drove into a courtyard. Behind us, the doors closed with a solid sound. I was inside Lubyanka Prison, headquarters of the KGB. I was taken into a small room where I was stripped and thoroughly searched. I was given a double-breasted black suit, several sizes too large, underwear, shirt, socks, shoes. The clothing was all old and worn. The pants were beltless, the shoes loafers without laces, so I'd have nothing with which to hang myself. From there, I was taken to a large room where some dozen people were waiting. A few wore uniforms, but most were in civilian clothes. There was no doubt they were big shots. I was seated at one end of a long table. There were no harsh lights in my eyes. The chair was not uncomfortable, but the interrogation atmosphere was unmistakable. The tactic I had decided upon was simple. When questioned, I would tell them the truth, up to a point, and with definite limitations. Should the question concern something I was sure they already knew, such as my route, which was on the maps, or something they could easily find out, such as the commanding officer of Detachment 1010, I would tell them the truth. Establishing a foundation of truthfulness on little things, I could risk lying on the big ones. My tactics were improvised. No one had briefed me on how to handle such a situation, and I was not at all sure they would work. But I had to try. Too much was at stake to do otherwise.
At what altitude were you flying when your flight was terminated?
This was, as far as I was concerned, one of the most important questions they could ask. Having already given it a great deal of thought, I replied, at maximum altitude for the plane, 68,000 feet. This was not one, but two lies. 68,000 feet was not the maximum altitude for the plane, nor was it the altitude at which I had been flying during this particular flight. It was an arbitrary figure I had chosen, close enough to my actual altitude to be credible, I hoped, far enough away so that if the overflights continued and the Russians used it as a setting for their missiles, they would miss their targets. It was important that they believe me. This was the main reason I decided to answer their questions rather than remain silent. My interrogators were, unfortunately, professionals. From their set expressions, I couldn't tell whether they believed me or not. I was taken to a cell about 8 feet wide and 15 feet long. The door appeared to be solid oak, reinforced by plate steel. After another search, the guard went out, slamming the door and locking it. I was alone, but still under surveillance. There was a small peephole in the door at eye level, while a light bulb over the door illuminated the room as brightly as if it were day. The bed was a metal frame with crisscrossed iron stripes in place of springs. There were two army-type blankets and a mattress, very lumpy and thin.
It seemed designed to be as uncomfortable as possible, and was. Though extremely tired, I slept only fitfully. I kept waking, looking around the room, as if to assure myself that it was only a bad dream. But the harsh glare, the stark walls, the locked door were always there. It was all too real. Morning, afternoon, evening, averaging 11 hours per day, 7 days per week, the interrogations were to continue without pause for 19 days. Then, after a single day's recess, start all over again. Although the cast occasionally varied, technical experts sometimes sitting in with questions of their own, 5 people were usually present at the interrogations. A stenographer, the interpreter, 2 majors, Kuzmin and Vasiliev, utilizing a good cop, bad cop routine. While one would be impatient and threatening, his partner would be sympathetic and kind. Although I recognized the tactic, this didn't keep me from halfway succumbing to it. And, last of all, a colonel. As a representative of the prosecutor's office, he was present to see that the interrogation proceeded in accordance with the law. Each night, on return to my cell, I would go over the questions again in my mind, trying to fit together, bit by bit, a composite picture of what they actually knew. I'm quite sure they were doing the same thing. And there were some surprises. Are you a good boxer? Puzzled, I replied that I wasn't a boxer. Then how did you get the black eye? Up to this time, I hadn't known I had one. Apparently, I had blacked it in the crash. Not having seen a mirror, I hadn't realized. The absence of mirrors was, of course, intentional. You get into the habit of seeing your face each morning. Without that reflection, you begin to lose a little of your sense of identity. It's amazing how much you miss a simple thing like a mirror. And without access to a scale, I couldn't tell how much weight I had lost. But it was a good amount, since I had to knot my pants at the waist to keep them up. I was far more worried about my heart. It would beat irregularly, all at once stop, then a big beat, and back into sequence again. It was ironic. I was convinced that sooner or later they were going to shoot me. At the same time, I was worried about an irregular heartbeat, which might take me off flying status. Morning interrogation always began the same way. I was asked to initial each page of the interrogation record of the previous day. But they're in Russian, I argued. I can't read Russian. That does not matter. It is required. Hour after hour, session after session, the interrogations continued. As the experts studied the wreckage, there were new questions. Usually, however, they were the same old ones, rephrased, approached from a different direction, in an attempt to catch me off guard, or simply repeat it over and over. On Tuesday, May 10th, on being taken to the morning interrogation, I told my inquisitors that I would refuse to answer further questions on any subject until I had proof the American government had been informed I was alive. Refusing to back down, I was returned to my cell. That afternoon, when the guard unlocked the door and motioned me out, I had the feeling this might be my last walk. Instead, I was taken to a larger interrogation room. State Prosecutor Rudenko and a number of other people were present. The interpreter had a copy of the New York Times dated Sunday, May 8th, only 2 days ago. He then read from a speech purportedly made by Khrushchev in which he said, "We have parts of the plane, and we also have the pilot, who is quite alive and kicking. The pilot is in Moscow, and so are the parts of the plane." "Can I see the paper?" I asked. "Not permitted." "You could be making that up. Or you could have had that paper printed right here in Moscow." They brought out other U.S. papers, quoting from interviews given the reactions of my wife and both my parents to the news. The comments of my mother and father were so typical that I couldn't doubt their veracity. "I'm going to appeal to Mr. Khrushchev personally," my father said. "To be fair to my boy, as one old coal miner to another, I'm sure he'll listen to me." I couldn't help it. I broke down and cried. The release of news of my capture marked a turning point in the interrogations. They became tougher. Now I had to try to outguess not one adversary, but two: Russian intelligence and the American press.
"You lied to us."
The blunt accusation stunned me. "What do you mean?" They had caught me at something, but what? The actual altitude of the U-2? The number of overflights I'd made? These and a dozen other possibilities ran through my mind as I waited for the interpreter to translate the reply.
"You told us you had never taken a lie detector test, but it says right here in the New York Times that you did."
I had lied about that. I didn't want them suggesting that, inasmuch as I had already taken one such test, I certainly couldn't object to another. At the time, it had seemed a safe lie. It was the kind of information I felt sure they would have no way of checking. I hadn't counted on a newspaper giving it to them for 10 cents.
"It says here that all the CIA job applicants are required to take polygraph tests."
"Well, that may be true of the agents," I replied. "But we were pilots, hired to fly airplanes." Toward the middle of May, I was taken out of the prison to examine the wreckage of the plane. A display had been set up in a building in Gorky Park. On the walls were large signs in Russian and English, the latter reading, "This is what the American spy was equipped with. Powers Francis Gary, the pilot of the shot American plane. Ammunition and outfit of the American spy." Below the signs were displays with my maps, identification, parachute, helmet, pressure suit, survival gear, knife, pistol, ammunition, first aid kit. Never before had I realized how identifiable everything on that plane was. The engine was stamped Pratt and Whitney. The camera bore the nameplates of its U.S. manufacturers. The destruct device was labeled Destructor Unit, Beekman and Whitley, Inc. Yet, had the destruct device been used, only a small portion of the aircraft, that containing the surveillance equipment, would have been destroyed. Again, it seemed no one had really considered the possibility the plane might go down in hostile territory. On June 30th, I was informed that the investigation was officially completed. There would be no further interrogations. My first reaction was relief. After 61 days, the questioning was finally over. Despite all their tricks, I had succeeded in keeping from them the most important things I knew. Another realization followed.
Now that the investigation was finished, I was that much closer to the trial. And whatever came after.
Hall of Columns was packed for the most dramatic trial that even Russia has staged for many years. Francis Gary Powers, U.S. pilot of the U-2 espionage plane, had pleaded guilty and could only hope that the sentence passed by the three judges, Lieutenant General Boris Adebsky presiding, would be lenient. As
was expected, my trial began on August 17th, my 31st birthday. Blinded by the flashbulbs and TV lights, with a guard holding either arm, I was escorted into the wooden prisoner's dock. Only then was I able to make out my surroundings. This was no courtroom, but an immense theater. Tall, white columns flanked all four walls. Hanging between them and from the ceiling were more than 50 chandeliers, all brilliantly lighted. The major participants, myself included, were at one end of the auditorium, on an elevated stage. Mikhail Grinev, my defense counsel, occupied a desk before the prisoner's dock. In a corresponding spot on the opposite side loomed the state prosecutor, Rodenko, wearing what looked like a streetcar conductor's uniform. Center stage, on a raised dais, were the three judges, all in military dress. Above and behind them on the wall rested a mammoth state seal with large gold hammer and sickle in the center. The audience, which filled the rest of the auditorium and its several balconies, numbered close to 1,000. Grinev had given me no warning. This was like being tried in Carnegie Hall. As a boy in school, I had suffered stage fright. Despite my attempts to hide it now, I was extremely nervous. The previous day, I had been issued a double-breasted blue pinstripe suit several sizes too large. The poor fit didn't make me any more comfortable. I looked intently for my family, but could not find them in the crowd. The presiding judge was speaking to me. The trial was to be conducted in Russian but simultaneously translated via a headset arrangement into English, French, German, and Spanish. Did I have any objections to the interpreters? I replied, no. There was a bench built into the dock. Noticing that everyone else was seated, I sat down.
Defendant, observed the presiding judge. You are obliged to stand when the court addresses you.
While I was still smarting from the rebuke, the judge asked my name, nationality, date and place of birth, family status, occupation, and whether I had received a copy of the indictment.
Defendant Powers, do you understand the charge brought against you?
Yes, I said. I understood all too well. This was no trial, but a show, and I wanted no part of it.
Accused Powers, do you plead guilty of the charge?
Yes, I plead guilty. The judge ordered a 20-minute recess. As I was being led out, I spotted Barbara, my wife, waving from a box in the rear of the courtroom, and saw my family for the first time. Neither of my parents had ever been outside the United States before. They looked so alone, so alien in this strange land, that I choked up. I was thankful for the break. I didn't want 1,000 people to see the tears in my eyes. It was a stacked deck, and Prosecutor Rodenko holding all the cards dealt them out one by one. In a sense, my replies didn't even matter. I was present merely as a symbol. And they were using that symbol to embarrass the United States, to put it on trial by proxy in the court of world opinion. Greenough said nothing. He did not make a single objection. He too was a symbol. His presence given the appearance of my being represented by counsel. But where my defense was concerned, he might as well have stayed at home. When at last it was Greenough's turn, he began by establishing that I came from a working-class family, that my parents were poor, my father not a capitalist, that is, did not employ any labor in his shoe shop, but did all the work himself, and that the money offered me by the CIA was the most I had ever received. Further questions brought out that I was not political, had never even voted in a U.S. election, knew very little about the Soviet Union except for what I had read in the American press. One by one, Greenough was establishing the mitigating circumstances.
Did you resist detention, or did you contemplate resisting?
No, I did not.
Voluntary surrender.
Have all your statements till now been truthful?
Yes, it is impossible to deny what I have done.
Complete cooperation. And again, sincere repentance.
What is your present attitude toward work in the CIA? And do you now understand the danger the flight entailed?
I understand a lot more now than I did before. Now that I know some of the circumstances of my flight, though I don't know all of them by any means, I am profoundly sorry I had any part in it. Now it was time to hear from the witnesses. First, looking exceedingly uncomfortable in suits and ties and obviously nervous about appearing before such a large audience, the four men from the State Farm, who were later decorated by the USSR for heroism, related the details of my capture. Asked if I had any questions for them, I said, I want to express my thanks for the help that was shown to me by all these people on that day. This is the first opportunity I've had to thank them.
Since voluntary surrender was one of the mitigating circumstances, I wanted it clearly established that I had not resisted capture and felt no antagonism toward them. It was now the turn of the expert witnesses. Functioning as a committee, each group had been assigned for study a certain portion of the evidence. The first group, after examining the various documents found on me or on the plane, concluded that
the pilot Francis Powers belongs to the Air Force of the United States of America.
Greenough didn't object, but by now I had given up expecting him to. The court seemed to accept their finding as fact.
Other witnesses, after lengthy examination of the special equipment, cameras, exposed film, radio receiving instruments, magnetic recorders, etc., concluded that they had been used for reconnaissance and that the purpose of the flight was espionage. Shortly afterward, the court adjourned until the next morning. The first sentences of Rudenko's summing up were typical of his whole oration.
Comrade judges, the trial of the American spy pilot Powers exposes the crimes committed not only by defendant Powers himself, but it completely unmasks the criminal aggressive actions of United States ruling circles, the actual inspirers and organizers of monstrous crimes directed against the peace and security of the peoples. I have all grounds to ask the court to pass an exceptional sentence on the defendant.
I had been right. They were going to make an example of me.
But taking into account Defendant Power's sincere repentance, before the Soviet court of the crime which he committed, I do not insist on the death sentence being passed on him, and ask the court to sentence the defendant to 15 years imprisonment.
After the intermission, Grinev began his summing up, and it became clear for the first time what his defense was to be.
Powers is only a pawn, though the direct perpetrator, he is not the main culprit.
Since I had refused to denounce the United States, Grinev was doing it for me.
When he signed his contract with the Central Intelligence Agency, Defendant Powers did not know the real purpose of the task set before him. Poisoned by the lies in the American press, he had been misinformed about the USSR.
With these considerations in mind, Grinev asked the court
to mitigate his punishment and to apply to Powers a more lenient measure of punishment than that demanded by the state prosecutor.
Then I was invited to make my final plea. I stood facing the judges. The lights of the television cameras were so bright that I had trouble reading the statement. But we'd gone over it so often that I knew the words. Some went against the grain. Some were deeply felt. I could only hope that in reading them, the American people could distinguish among them. You have heard all the evidence of the case, and you must decide what my punishment is to be. I realize that I have committed a grave crime, and I realize that I must be punished for it. I ask the court to weigh all the evidence and take into consideration not only the fact that I committed the crime, but also the circumstances which led me to do so. I also ask the court to take into consideration the fact that no secret information reached its destination. It all fell into the hands of the Soviet authorities. I realize the Russian people think of me as an enemy. I can't understand that, but I would like to stress the fact that I do not feel, nor have I ever felt, any enmity whatsoever for the Russian people. I plead the court to judge me not as an enemy, but as a human being who is not a personal enemy of the Russian people, who has never had any charges brought against him in any court, and who is deeply repentant and profoundly sorry for what he has done. Thank you. At 5:30 p.m., 4 hours and 40 minutes after the judges went out, I was summoned back into the courtroom. While I stood, my hands gripping the wooden railings on either side of the prisoner's dock, the presiding judge read the verdict. It was a lengthy document, so long, in fact, that I suspected it had been written well in advance and not during the few hours the judges were out. That it was available to the reporters in printed form immediately upon conclusion of the trial would appear to confirm this. The photographers moved into place. I was determined to show no emotion, whatever the sentence, but my fingers gripped the railing even tighter.
The Military Division of the USSR Supreme Court sentences Francis Gary Powers on the strength of Article 2 of the USSR Law on Criminal Responsibility for State Crimes to 10 years of confinement.
I didn't hear the rest. I looked for my family, but in the confusion couldn't see them. All over the hall, people had stood and were applauding. Whether because they felt the sentence suitably harsh or humanely lenient, I did not know. Only as I was being led from the courtroom did the full impact of the sentence hit me. 10 long years.